From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Today, we explore creativity. We'll look at uncreative writing.
Who cares about art grain? Nobody. Nobody cares about real poetry. What people care about is kind of the language that's around them.
We'll learn how to steal like an artist.
As an artist or a young artist, you're only going to be as good as the stuff you're surrounding yourself with. You're literally a mashup of what you let into your life.
And Suzzy Roach talks about how she channels the creativity she uses for writing songs to write her debut novel.
It's almost like going to a river and fishing or something. There's a river where this stuff comes from, and for me, it's very mysterious. I hardly ever feel that I've done something, created something by myself.
But first, the story of a remarkable study on creativity. It was the mid-60s in Menlo Park, California, and dozens of scientists were brought into a lab to test a simple question. Would a single hit of LSD boost their creativity? Psychologist James Fadiman was part of this research team. Steve Paulson recently sat down with Fadiman to talk about the experiment and later studies of psychoactive drugs.
Jim, take me back to the summer of 1966, when you and your research team in California invited a number of scientists into your lab and gave them LSD. What were you looking for?
We were determining whether one could use LSD in a moderate dose in a very safe setting to solve very difficult scientific problems. This was not to have visions. This was not to have extraordinary music. This was simply to see if you could use the lens of a psychedelic to tightly focus down on a scientific problem that our scientists had been struggling with up to 3 months and had so far failed.
So this was an exercise in creativity to see if LSD could unleash people's creative powers.
Exactly. And we limited ourselves to hard science because it was generally known that artists were already experimenting with it, and that was interesting. But hard science is a much better way to determine if you've actually made a creative breakthrough.
Now, this was 1966, and this was actually government regulated, right?
Yeah, we had an investigational drug license from the Food and Drug Administration to use these substances both clinically and in this other way.
So you brought in a bunch of scientists.
We brought in senior scientists from a number of the local industries that were developing a lot of different products, and we also brought in some professors who were doing theoretical research. So we had problems ranging from Norgate theory, which is an abstract mathematical area used in circuit design, to space probes for solar properties, microtome, improvements in tape recording technology. We also had some architects, and we basically said we want projects that your clients have consistently already turned you down with.
So you gave them, what, one dose of LSD?
We gave them one dose of LSD or mescaline, and we used them interchangeably. One dose, and then we gave them several hours of internal reflection with music and eye shades. And then basically we allowed them to go full bore on their problems. And to our delight with the first group, it went exactly as we said it would. And then from that point on, we simply were allowing people to participate, because what happened is people would go back to their lab groups, and then we would get calls, can we also participate in this experiment? So it was a very pleasant and kind of genuinely exciting experience for these scientists. And all but two of our subjects had no psychedelic experience prior. So this was their only exposure.
So you're saying that one dose of LSD somehow allowed them to figure out, perhaps solve certain problems that they'd been struggling with for 3 months?
That was exactly the case. And the reason we wanted them to have struggled is we wanted them to be emotionally involved and to have emotional blocks by this time, meaning when the client's been mad at you for 3 months, when you're trying to earn a living and your supervisor is saying, are you making no progress? So we wanted problems that they essentially had been frustrated by, so that it, in a sense, upped the amperage of their desire to solve the problem. And solutions rolled out with amazing regularity.
after just one dose of
Dose, they were given 3 to 4 hours basically of intense work. The comments from a number of them is the work was not noticeably better than their own good work, but instead of weeks, it was minutes. And that was, of course, extraordinary in its own right. And the other side of that is that we asked them several months later, had there been any residual creative effect? And what they said is, yes, that up to several months, and we didn't really ask beyond that, they had increased creativity, slowly diminishing back to their baseline. And the main way they were more creative is they were more focused. They were able to let go of solutions that weren't working. And the other thing, and this is peculiar to psychedelics, they were much more easily able to see patterns that they had not noticed before. So many of them said, I suddenly was able to take a totally new approach.
So how do you explain this? What was going on in their minds?
Well, what seems to happen with psychedelics is that the self, the personality, the part that's frustrated or irritated or concerned, am I really smart enough, all those things are, they're lowered in intensity. And if you think about a problem for which you're capable of solving, in a way, all the information for the solution must be already present. But what you're blocked is finding it and putting it together in the right way.
So you kind of already know this, or somewhere, in some deep recess of your mind, you know the answer. The question is how to access it.
Exactly. A lot of creativity is this sort. It is that ability to access all of your information without any emotional blocks that seems to be the reason.
Now, one of the peculiar features of this story is that I know that while you were actually doing your research, you got a letter from the FDA saying, stop, this is no longer legal.
We got a letter from the FDA because we had a license to do this work, and they said to us and to 60 other projects that day, to be fair, that as of the receipt of this letter, your research is terminated. Our little team looked at this letter, and we had 4 senior scientists in the other room with headphones and their eye shades, the music going, and we were about to get them up to work on their problems. And I was very much the youngest member of the team. And I looked around at my colleagues and said, I think we got this letter tomorrow. And they agreed. We put the letter in the drawer. We worked with those last 4 people, and then we discovered the letter the next day. And the research was terminated.
Why was the research terminated?
Well, all the research in the country was terminated. My own theory, and this is total speculation, is this was at the time when there was rampant widespread use of psychedelics, which was fueling the anti-war movement, among other things. It was fueling upset in universities. So there are a lot of people who are frightened by all these movements. And I think someone in Washington said, we got to stop these kids taking all these drugs. And everyone went, yes, yes, yes. And then someone said, well, who could we stop? And then someone, and I, if I knew who he was, I'd be angry at him, said, why don't we stop the researchers?
But there had also been a lot of public attention to the misuse of psychedelics, and a lot of people say that Timothy Leary especially was to blame. I mean, he basically encouraged the irresponsible use of this, and some bad things happened to people who took these very powerful mind-altering substances.
Well, there's another way of construing that same history, which is if you actually listen to what Tim said, Tim actually eagerly promoted responsible use. So in some sense, Tim is kind of maligned slightly by history. And Ken Kesey is not given enough credit for setting a model of the kind of behavior that just terrified the establishment.
Ken Kesey and his merry pranksters had been going around on their bus doing all kinds of crazy things, including taking psychedelics.
Absolutely. So there were lots of forces. There were all the bands who were using. But predominantly, the fear in the establishment was not of young people hurting themselves, but of young people coming home and criticizing their parents' lifestyle and reasons for being, really reasons for existing.
Now, you had your own personal history with this, right? I mean, actually,
some
years before that. I mean, you'd been a student of Richard Alpert, later known as Ram Dass, who, with Timothy Leary, did those famous studies at Harvard on psychedelics.
I was an undergraduate at Harvard, and Dick Alpert, who was an up-and-rising assistant professor, was my favorite professor, and I was one of his favorite students. We actually did research together one summer at Stanford. And after college, I ended up in Paris, and he came to Paris and said to me, the most wonderful thing in the world has happened to me, and I want to share it with you. Now, he was on his way to Paris with Tim Leary to join Aldous Huxley for the first public discussion of this research at an international psychology meeting.
What year was this?
This was 61. So I said what anyone would say, well, gee, that sounds great. And he reached into his jacket pocket and came out with a little bottle of pills. And I looked at it and I thought, what on earth is going on? I mean, I knew nothing about nothing. And I had a moderate dose of what was then psilocybin, and sat at a little cafe, and the colors got brighter, and the conversations behind me, I could hear them all clearly. And my French was quite poor, so I'd never been able to hear them clearly before. And I then ended up a week later following this little crew to Copenhagen. And then I very soon thereafter came to Stanford as a graduate student. I was offered the alternative of going to Vietnam, and it felt like psychology needed me more than the Army. And then I fell in with a small group with part Stanford professors and part people who were just funding it, and had a much more profound experience October 19th, 1961, in which my worldview truly underwent a serious transformation that is fortunately not recovered from.
What happened during that experience?
During that experience, I understood that there was an identity of some sort, which was larger than my personality, larger than Jim Fadiman. The feeling of being connected to more rather than separated from more became predominant.
Now, we were saying this was the mid-60s when you were doing this, height of the Vietnam War, counterculture was in full force. You were hanging out with Ken Kesey, right?
That's true.
So you were a counterculture guy yourself.
Well, I had this wonderful bicultural, so to speak, or multiple personality perhaps. But by day, I was a graduate student at Stanford. And by night, I was a serious psychedelic researcher. And on and off, I was also very peripheral to the Kesey world. My wife actually had been dating Ken, and This was before she was my wife, definitely. So I was a very marginal member of that much more exploratory and exciting kind of side of things, where they didn't know what they were doing and took enormous risks. We didn't know what we were doing and were very, very careful.
Well, and then there's another piece of this history, which is going back to your creativity study with the scientists in the 60s. It turns out that a number of well-known scientists and designers and tech people took psychedelics. I mean, Steve Jobs has famously said LSD was one of the two or three most important experiences of his life. There are other stories as well. I mean, there's an argument that actually psychedelics had a big impact in the founding of Silicon Valley.
Well, it's not an argument. It's merely a checklist. But what we do know is that a number of heads of corporations in Silicon Valley use psychedelics in this way. They used it with the intention of looking at technical problems. We know that Cary Mullis, a Nobel Prize winner, who developed recombinant DNA that we see in all the legal cases, that came, he says, directly from his use of psychedelics. He did not have the great insight while on a psychedelic. He makes that a point. But he had learned how to get inside a molecule and look around. And that is what led to this discovery.
You've also been an advocate recently of what is known as microdoses of some of these substances, LSD and some other things. I mean, basically tiny, almost imperceptible amounts?
That's actually the term. They're called a sub-perceptual dose, which is less than you would notice. And as one person says, when you have a microdose, the rocks don't glisten even a little. And so that's approximately a tenth of what people take perhaps to go to a concert. And what we're finding is that there are uses for this. One is it doesn't bother anyone and it doesn't bother the culture. So you can take a microdose and go to the bank and be a bank manager or be a physician or be a rock musician. And what you will find at the end of the day, and these are mainly written reports being written around the country to me, I had a really good day. Things went better. I was a little nicer. I was a little kinder. I ate a little more healthy. My kids didn't bug me, even though they did the thing that bugs me. So it's not a major event.
You know, listening to you, it strikes me that you are still the counterculture figure here. Maybe not in the same way you were in the 60s, you know, when you were hanging out with Ken Kesey, but you're still jousting with the establishment.
Well, I would no longer say I'm counterculture. I am asking of the mainstream culture, of which I'm a member. I'm married. I have kids. I have grandkids. I'm not that interesting. But the culture now, with all those millions of people who have shared experiences such as the ones I've described, are not resisting. The fascinating thing to me is when we do the smallest, most uninteresting little psychedelic study, the press goes wild, and there are hundreds of references to the research, and none are negative. That's the thing that is quite fascinating. There's something happening in the culture that is not yet understood by the legislative branch, and that is that these substances are no longer seen as terrifying. They're seen as very powerful. But so is your automobile. But you don't then jail people for wanting to use them. So the culture has changed. Even in the psychedelic world, I'm considered somewhat right-wing because I think people should use these only if they know what they're doing. And so I think what we're moving toward is a kind of user's license for psychedelics, which is, do you know what you're doing, or are you not going to hurt yourself or other people? Also, other countries are doing it other ways. Portugal, for instance, everything is legal. Now, what happened? Oh, all the things that were that the naysayers were terrified of. Use of every psychedelic has gone down. Use of hard drugs has gone down. Use of cocaine, heroin. Hospitalizations have gone down. People going into treatment has gone up. Why? Because the government says you're allowed to get treatment for what used to be illegal. So here's a perfectly normal European country that says, let's change our drug laws entirely away from the United States model. And really, I think we're all amazed as how sane and grown up people, police, hospital systems, judicial systems can be. Now, people are still arrested for crimes in Portugal, but they're not stealing to support a drug habit for which now they can get treatment.
This is all quite fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Jim Fadiman, author of The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide. If you want to hear more about Fadiman's experiences with Ken Kesey or the origins of transpersonal psychology, you'll find Steve's complete uncut interview on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, more in our Hour on Creativity with singer-songwriter Suzzy Roach. And Austin Kleon tells us why it's okay to steal like an artist. And Jim Fleming, it's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Some creative people express themselves through music. Others pour their vivid imagination into novels. And there's still others who do both, like Suzzy Roach. She's best known as one of the founding members of the folk rock trio The Roaches, along with her sisters, Maggie and Terry. But Suzzy Roach has turned her attention from writing songs to writing fiction. She's just published her first novel, Wayward Saints. It's the story of Mary Saint, the troubled former lead singer of the rock band Sliced Ham. How much of an adjustment was it for Roach to go from stage to the page?
You know, it's much more solitary writing a book, obviously, and it's much longer to write a book. And there's a story and a visual element. It's almost like watching a movie, writing a book, watching it in your own little brain or dreaming it up or something like that. But then again, I was trained as an actress, and I also think that my songs are kind of character-driven most of the time anyway. So in that way, there were similarities.
So you've been creating characters to sing about all this time. One of the differences, I would think, is that writing songs, there's a more immediate feedback. There's more involvement, maybe because they're shorter. I don't know, because you can sing them to somebody. You can't exactly read a chapter of your novel to your sisters, can you?
No, it's a big commitment for someone to read a book. It's a lot shorter if they listen to a song. Someone has to be willing to go into an entire world, an alternate universe. I think it's harder these days for people to concentrate that much on an entire book.
On the other hand, you talk about being a character on stage. You were trained as an actress, you said. Are you, when you perform on stage, someone in addition to yourself?
Yes, I've always thought of it that way. I've always acted like a singer. I think that part of my job is to entertain people on stage, and so I'm not particularly that entertaining in my regular life. Actually, I'm kind of shy, so I always approached it as a character.
Was it appealing to you because of that to move that world into a world of fiction away from the world of performance?
Yes. Well, I wanted to write about faith, really, and that's what I think is at the heart of my novel. But I did want it to have a sort of fantastical world, and I think the world of rock and roll is totally absurd, and it sort of meshes very nicely with the world of faith because there is an unreality about both things.
Well, and we're always told to write about what we know, and certainly you know the world of performance. I'm not sure that the world you describe in Wayward Saints is one that I think of the Roaches as inhabiting.
Yes, the Roaches were a folk band, you know. I mean, we were not rock and roll like Mary Saint is. I wanted to write about a girl rocker chick, somebody like maybe Eminem, you know, who I think is brilliant, but, you know, a lot of people won't even listen to him because of the language he uses or what they think he might be talking about. And I think that's very similar to the issues of faith and God. Some people are just totally turned off by the whole subject. So again, those two things were parallel, and I needed to create a character who was so extremely objectionable to some people. And that's what I tried to do with Mary.
Well, it's interesting to hear you talk about those worlds running parallel to each other, because it is hard to imagine faith in the rock and roll world of Mary Saint. Part of what you've done in the novel is to bring faith into her life, but also to have a sort of parallel story of her mother going on at the same time.
Yes, I think that the perception that her mother has of her, she's almost afraid of her daughter and the behavior that she has, you know, adopted. And Jean Saint, the mother, is a very religious Catholic, and almost everything about Mary, her daughter, goes against that. So it's very painful. Plus, mother and daughter and the father, who was an abusive father in their family, you know, they've all suffered a big pain. I wanted the two characters to approach healing from their separate corners, really.
Maybe the best way to get an idea of the main character, Mary, is to have you read a little bit of the story. Do you have a section that you could read, and could you introduce us to it?
Yes. This section is sort of midway through the book when we first really meet Mary, and this is after her band has, the star has risen and crashed, and she is left in her own life with no friends, no business relationships anymore, and she's sort of just stunned at what has happened to her, and she's sitting at her kitchen table remembering her life on the road. The memories of what her life once was were absurd. Adventures on that thing called the road. Sometimes it seemed as if a person could fly, but the humiliations and failures were so extreme, so public. Rave reviews and then vicious dismissals. All those stained toilet bowls and sticky floors, freezing dressing rooms, dented aluminum ashtrays overflowing with cigarettes and joints, platters of curled up salami and wilted American cheese, bottles of tequila with worms at the bottom that were supposed to be swallowed, posters of bands, mostly guys in leather pants, their crotches bulging, hairy arms inked with tattoos of girls and dragons, photographs of herself posing with electric guitars in ridiculous outfits that she had thought she ought to wear, ripped stockings, garter belts, and makeup like war paint, attitudes, her own and everyone else's, songs that she wrote from the heart and what they actually turned out to be, who people thought she was and who she really was, who she thought she was and who she turned out to be. Fans cheering, "We love you, Mary Saint, sliced ham, sliced ham." It had been a long tilt-a-whirl ride, the predictable cliches, hotel lobbies, airport bars, and the exquisite uniqueness of those very same cliches. The world was a carnival, the ghoulishness, the costumes, the buffoons, the down-and-out, drug-laden, liquor-soaked good old times, the goofiness, the innocence, the mistakes and cruelties, the magical shows, the mixture of fakery and truth, the sadness and the laughs, all the things that people used to say about her, to her, the things that she had said, shooting her mouth off, hurting herself and others, being cheered on like a pit bull in a ring. All of this led up to the death of Anthony, the event that had cut her life in half and ended his. This is what she remembered of herself. She'd wrestled with her lover until he fell to his death off the balcony of a hotel room. Why? Because in the end, someone in a newspaper said that she was fat and stupid. She had lost herself along the way. This was all she had to go on.
That's an extraordinary description. In some ways, it's almost as though she's looking back at a novel of somebody else's life, isn't it?
Yeah, and I do think that that does happen to people when they get successful. When you're successful, it happens very quickly. You just get on the train and you don't stop until one day it's always going to end, you know? I mean, there's never going to be just a constant trajectory of success. There's ebbs and flows. And with her, it was over. The day it was over, it was over. And I think that happens to a lot of people in this business.
The act of writing this was more inward, more personal, but it's about a world which is more outward. And I suppose that the world performance does rely on other people more.
Yes, it's mysterious what makes somebody popular. There are some people who are so talented, they could do everything, and for some reason, they don't have an audience. And then there's someone like Mary Saint who has this kind of inexplicable talent.
In your mind, I know we've talked a little bit about the difference between songwriting and novel writing, but I'm really fascinated by whether the well of creativity is the same in both. Somewhere those characters live and you have to find them to write about them, don't you?
Yes, and I think, again, that's where the issue of faith comes in. It's similar to writing a song. If you sit there and put the time in, something will come out, and it may not be what you thought would happen. It's almost like going to a river and fishing or something. There's a river where this stuff comes from, and for me, it's very mysterious. I hardly ever feel that I've done something, created something by myself.
I'm curious, I guess, also about the creativity involved in songwriting, because you have to be pithy. It doesn't give you much time to flesh out characters, does it? Whereas a novel demands that you fully realize characters.
Yeah. In that way, they're really opposite. And in fact, after I wrote Wayward Saints, I wrote the song for Wayward Saints. I was curious to see what would the book be if it was a song. And I guess the difference is that you take the essence out of the thing. It's almost like squeezing an orange and getting the juice out of it. When I finally wrote the song, I said, oh, that's what the book is about. And I thought that was an interesting reversal to go from the book to the song.
What's the matter, baby? You look sad and lonely, like you're about to fall apart. Why not look me in the eye? Tell me the reason why. You don't trust anyone. You're crooked.
That's Suzzy Roach, along with her daughter Lucy Wainwright Roach, performing Song for Wayward Saints. Suzzy Roach is the author of Wayward Saints. If you have questions or comments about the program, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, the fine art of stealing, like an artist, and uncreative writing, as we conclude our hour on creativity. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Read any good books lately? Well, if not, maybe you should write the book you want to read. That's just one of the pieces of creative advice that writer and artist Austin Kleon offers in his book, Steal Like an Artist, 10 Things Nobody Told You About Being Creative. Kleon talks with Anne Strainchamps.
The title is a playoff of something that's actually misattributed to Picasso. Good artist copy, great artist steal. As far as I can tell, Picasso actually never said that. It was actually T.S. Eliot. He was talking about poets. I was shocked myself to find out how many artists really use that term, stealing. And it's not just artists, it's people of all fields. Someone like Steve Jobs or Kobe Bryant. He talks about stealing basketball moves when he was watching tapes when he was young. Someone like Francis Ford Coppola will say, you steal when you're younger, and then you add something new to the pot, and then pretty soon people are stealing from you.
It's so interesting, though, because you're talking about people who we think of as some of the great creative geniuses. And we have that idea that what's really valuable in art or business or entertainment or, you know, whatever your form of art is, what's really valuable is originality.
Yeah, and in human history, the whole concept of originality is kind of an invention of the 19th century. We really don't have this idea of a lone creative genius until the Romanticists really come along. Before, someone had a genius or they had geniuses that kind of like guided their lives. But then when Romanticism comes around, we have this idea that there's like this person that's kind of ordained by the gods with this unique creative ability. I guess my big quest with the book is to just kind of upend that a little bit and to say, actually, nothing comes from nowhere, and that all these creative geniuses that we think of, they were all thieves, and they all borrowed liberally, and they took things and they reworked them, and their genius, if you can call it that, is actually the way that they take their influences and gave us something new.
So you take this concept of stealing like an artist. If art is theft, then there should be a skill to it. And you sort of turn it into almost a lifestyle. So can you kind of start going through some? I mean, if you're a young artist starting out and somebody says to you, no, 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 don't worry about being original, just go out and steal. What do you do?
Well, it's almost like a conceptual thing. It's almost like a way of thinking about what you do. My big thing that I tell young artists is that you are a mashup of what you let into your life. And that actually comes from something my mother used to say to me, which used to drive me insane. She used to say, garbage in and garbage out. That drove me so crazy when I was young, but now I realize that she was dead on. There's a DJ named DJ Spooky, and he says, as a DJ, you're only going to be as good as your record collection. So what that means is, as an artist or a young artist, you're only going to be as good as the stuff you're surrounding yourself with. And that includes not only the books you read, the art you look at, your teachers, but it also includes your environment, where you choose to live, your friends. It's everything. You're literally a mashup of what you let into your life.
Okay, well, so as a young person, let's say you say, great, then I'm going to make sure that all the music I listen to is really great music and that I only read the best literature. Then what? I'm going to sort of wake up one morning and make great art?
I think what happens is after you start gathering your influences, then you start copying. And we're not talking about plagiarism here. We're talking about learning the moves. Like, if you're Kobe Bryant, you watch the tapes, you know, you see Jordan's moves, and then you try them out on the basketball court. Now, what happens is, as you try to copy these heroes, you start realizing that you're not quite built like them. I'm using the basketball metaphor because I think it's easier. You start realizing that your body's different, that you have to start adapting, that you're incapable of perfectly copying these heroes, that you have to make adjustments to suit your own personality. The stuff that you have through your life influences and things like that starts seeping in. And then after you start copying your heroes, you start combining them together to get interesting combinations. And then finally, I always think of it as like you take something from one hero and you take something from the other, and pretty soon you have this kind of Frankenstein monster of your work. And then part of your job is to start transforming that monster into something smooth, something that kind of stands on its own.
At what point did you begin doing the newspaper blackout poems?
The newspaper blackout started right after I got out of college. You know, I studied creative writing in college. I actually did go to, like, creative writing workshops. And the thing about creative writing workshops and about college in general is college is this perfect environment for a young writer because you have a captive audience. You've got people paying to read your writing, your fellow students, and then you've got a professor who's getting paid to read your writing and pay attention to it. So you have like what every artist or writer dreams of, this captive audience. And then when you get out, you realize that no one cares, you know, that you like have to start from ground zero and you have to build a readership and you have to do something that people aren't artificially paying attention to you. And so when I got out of college, I had no outlet anymore. And I froze up. And I submitted a few short stories to journals and got rejections just like every young writer. And I suddenly realized that I was writing short stories. I mean, I like short stories, but that wasn't really what I wanted to do. I wrote short stories because that's what they teach you to write in college. So I started a blog. And one of the things about having a blog is you have to fill it with something. And one day I was staring at my Microsoft Word screen and that cursor was just blinking at me like it was taunting me, you know, and I was trying to like pull something original out of my soul, and I looked in the recycle bin with all these newspapers stacked up in it, and I thought, man, I don't have any words, but right there next to me are millions of them. So I picked up one of my drawing markers and I just started circling words and then blacking out the rest, and I thought I was ripping off the government. I thought I was doing like redacted CIA haikus. But it turns out that there was actually this long history of people finding poetry in the newspaper. After I started posting them to my blog, people started telling me that there was this long history. But instead of getting discouraged that my idea wasn't completely original, I built my own family tree. I researched the form. I went back as far as I could go. And I stole everything I could from the people who came before. And I tried to make my poems better. And in a couple of years, I put out my first book, Newspaper Blackout.
Do you remember one? Can you recite any?
Yeah, probably one of my favorites, or a kind of a fan favorite, is called Overheard on the Titanic. And it was actually a music review. And it's very short, but it goes, I mean, yes, we're sinking, but the music is exceptional.
Austin, when you give these talks to young people now, what do you say at the end?
The thing I say at the end is YMMV, your mileage may vary. I say there are no rules. Have fun. Make up your own rules. Take what you can from me, steal what you can, and make your own thing.
Austin Kleon is the author of Steal Like an Artist, 10 Things Nobody Told You About Being Creative. He spoke with Ann Strainchamps. Could you imagine taking a class in uncreative writing? A class in which you're penalized for showing any originality and creativity. Instead, you're rewarded for plagiarism, plundering, and stealing. Well, if this sounds appealing to you, then Kenneth Goldsmith is your man. He teaches an uncreative writing course at the University of Pennsylvania. Goldsmith is also a poet, writer, and author of the book Uncreative Writing, Managing Language in the Digital Age. He tells Steve Paulson that literature is in a rut, and has a ways to go to catch up with other art forms.
Much of the most popular music is made entirely from cutting and pasting. Nobody would dare play drums on a track today. You sample drums. This is happening in art. 100 years ago, Marcel Duchamp took a urinal and recontextualized it, didn't do a thing to it, just put it into a different context. And that's already 100 years old, and that's old hat. Somehow, writing has never engaged with these ideas that are rampant all over the rest of culture.
So you're saying the digital media has challenged writers to do something different, maybe to be more experimental, and in the process to give up some of our old ideas about what creative writing is all about, what originality is all about.
Well, I actually don't think that this is really that unoriginal. As a matter of fact, you can cut and paste in very original and very unique and very expressive ways. You can create an entire novel that you haven't written that nobody else could write by the way that you've cut, pasted, and sewn it together. I mean, this, again, of course, goes right back to hip-hop tracks and things that nobody even would think twice about in other parts of culture.
Well, I have to ask you about an event that you were part of, actually at the White House, so President and Mrs. Obama's celebration of American poetry. And I know you read some of your work there, including a piece called Traffic. Can you tell me about this work, Traffic?
Well, I mean, it's a transcription on New York radio. We have wonderful traffic here in New York. New York News Radio, a wonderful station that's very old called 1010 Winds, is round-the-clock news. Every 10 minutes, they give the traffic report. So this was a book that was 24 hours worth of traffic reports every 10 minutes on the ones, as they say.
Could you give us a sample of this?
Are you ready?
Sure.
Okay. 431. Remember how bad it was yesterday? It's starting again. The east side delays begin at the Tory Borough. It's pretty much one long line now all the way to the Battery. The west side delays to the Battery begin back at the Boat Basin at 79th Street. We've got a ton of interior traffic in Midtown. 7th Avenue, Times Square, that's the delay. That's where it all gets going. It comes out of Central Park. Broadway and 8th Avenue is going to be impacted by that as well. On the east side streets are packed through the 40s and 50s, and that's why 1st, 2nd, 3rd, Park Avenue right now, an absolute mess. So trying to get around Manhattan just like yesterday is not going to be easy at all. Across the East River, already a ton of traffic each way on the Brooklyn Bridge. Now the Manhattan Bridge is bumper to bumper coming into Manhattan. Jam-packed on the upper roadway to Brooklyn. The lower roadway is also a mess. 59th Street Bridge is getting real bad. The belt is jammed east off the Verrazano. Some types of problems on the way west toward Coney Island. And right now, heavy transit delays. Be sure to budget extra travel time taking the LIRR out of Penn Station. There you have it.
So that's what you read to President Obama.
I read traffic reports to the President of the United States.
And how did that go over at the White House?
They loved it. They absolutely loved it. It was very funny because I chose to put together a little set about an American icon, the Brooklyn Bridge. And so I read three short pieces, an excerpt from Walt Whitman's Crossing Brooklyn Ferry, written in 1840 before there was a bridge there. And then I went through Hart Crane's poem about the Brooklyn Bridge, which is a kind of a disjunctive modernist thing. And then finally ended up with Traffic, what I just read for you. Now, the audience, who was really senators and mayors and, you know, Democratic Party donors, sat there very politely and quietly through the Whitman and the Crane, the real poetry. But when they heard the traffic reports...
They were laughing, I bet.
They were howling. There's a shot of Obama leaning back in his chair with a giant smile across his face, listening to the traffic report. Maybe it's vernacular. I mean, maybe this is just language that people can understand, right? I mean, who understands Hart Crane? Who cares about Hart Crane? Nobody. Nobody cares about real poetry. What people care about is kind of the language that's around them. And of course, these are Washington bureaucrats, so they had ideas about gridlock and congestion and delay. You know, there really is narrative in there as well, in a way that Whitman gives you impression or Crane gives you disjunction. I'm actually giving you narrative, but I didn't write any of these. So this is the weird thing. The most avant-garde, the most unoriginal, the most uncreative work was the work that went over the very best in the White House.
Now, you are not only a writer, you're also a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and you teach a class called Uncreative Writing. Can you tell me about this class?
Sure. In this class, students are penalized for any shred of originality or creativity that they show. They must be uncreative for an entire semester.
Meaning what they write can only be taken from other sources, copied?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They can only appropriate, transcribe, copy, you know, the kind of stuff that I do.
And why is this the requirement of the class?
Well, the idea is to move away from what you know. As a college professor, I can get them better at writing. But quite frankly, at the University of Pennsylvania, they all know how to write pretty well, particularly, you know, at upper levels. So what are we going to do? We're going to keep honing that short story so you can, you know, market it. That's fine. It's somebody else's job. My job is really to challenge them and to get them to think differently about what writing is and what the creative process is. We do exercises, and one of the best exercises we do is I just tell them simply, with no further instruction, I say, retype 5 pages. And they shrug their shoulders and they leave the class. But the next week they come in with the assignment, 5 pages, and that's where it gets very interesting. What did you choose to type? How did you choose to type it? Why did you choose to type it? And suddenly, all these autobiographical ideas and ideas of choices and tastes all come into the seemingly innocuous idea of retyping 5 pages. And suddenly, they go, aha, I wasn't thinking about that, but of course I was making choices, and making choices is an uncreative slash creative act.
But you're also, it sounds like, asking your students to plagiarize what someone else has already written, right?
Absolutely.
Which is the kind of thing that usually gets students kicked out of school.
Well, you know, I encourage plagiarism. You must plagiarize in my class. You know, these kids are so good at plagiarism, but they always have to do it surreptitiously. And, you know, in my class, I say, you may not do it surreptitiously. You've got to put it all out on the table. Now tell me why you did it. Let's get responsible about your plagiarism. What choices did you make? When kids plagiarize, they're not really thinking about the sort of formal choices that they're making. So it becomes an enlightening thing. Now, of course, academically, this is really the worst thing you can do. As a matter of fact, at the end of each class, I make them buy a term paper from a paper mill and put their name to it and turn it in as their final project. But then they've got to get up and they've got to defend it as if it's theirs.
But you're supporting a corrupt industry of, you know, the people who write those term papers for someone else and for someone else's name.
Absolutely. We are. And the best time is when we can get university funds to actually purchase these papers.
I can't imagine how this goes over with other professors, with other writers. Some people must be furious at you.
No, nobody's furious. You know, listen, no animals were harmed during the making of this movie. This is safe. This is consensual. It's like an S&M club. You know, you go in and you role play and everybody's cool with it. You know, and those are the rules. This is the thing about a classroom. I mean, it's controlled and it's safe. And really, nobody's really getting hurt here.
So what do you think students learn by taking your uncreative writing class?
Well, I mean, they learn to make decisions and they learn to become accountable. I mean, everything must be articulated. It's more like what I would assume law school is like. You have to learn to take somebody else's point of view, even if you don't believe it. I mean, this is happening sort of in the legal profession all the time. So you're getting outside of yourself. You're adopting things that aren't yours. You're judging language in a very different way than you've ever seen it. And the best thing that can come out of this, I think, is one of the great things is that they reject this way of working. I say, look, suspend your disbelief for a semester. And then, if you don't like this way of working, you can actually say, again, it's defensible, I've tried it and I don't like it. This is crap. But often what happens is this becomes another tool in a writer's toolbox. And I think this is actually a very contemporary tool for writers to be using.
It sounds like you're saying that even though you call your class uncreative writing, this is an exercise in creativity.
Creativity is sort of so formulaic and so sort of bankrupt at this point that it's really, I think, the thing to flee from.
Why is it bankrupt, though?
Creativity is not creative. You know, it's the 100,000th coming-of-age novel. Actually, I want to talk about the shortlist for the 2011 Man Booker Prize.
Okay.
4 of the 6 shortlisted novels advertise themselves as featuring immigrants negotiating the difficulties of a strange land. 5 of the 6 hinge on the dramatic turn of a murder. 4 of the 6 reveal secrets from the past that come unexpectedly to light. I mean, this is from the website of the Man Booker, okay? 5 of those, through the surprise arrival of a letter. 4 of the 6 reveal the unreliability of narration and so on, they're all kind of formulaic. And this is what's passing, really, for the what we're calling the best literature. That's not creative to me.
You're saying there's nothing new to be said anymore. It's all just rehashing what someone else has already written.
Well, you know, I think there are new things to be said. Who hasn't been moved by a beautiful memoir or by a beautiful novel? I don't want to be so prescriptive in that way. But again, I feel that we've limited ourselves to these sort of same variations on narratives, and it's kind of time to open up the field a little bit more to other ways of being, those ways perhaps being uncreative or unoriginal.
But I think the response that you get from a lot of novelists is it's not just the themes that matter, it's the way you put together the sentences. It's the use of language to create imaginative spaces. Are you saying that's not important, or we've just misrepresented that?
No, I'm saying that is important, but I'd actually say that the way that those texts are constructed are fairly conventional and fairly similar. Again, there's a whole century of experimentation with language, which is completely ignored. There's many, many ways to construct novels. We actually just tend to construct novels quite similarly. Just a call to open things up. Let's get a little more contemporary.
Kenneth Goldsmith is the author of Uncreative Writing, Managing Language in the Digital Age. He spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, go to our website at ttbook.org or visit us on our Facebook fan page. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Creative Insight. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Sarah Nix. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.